What Women Must Know with Sheryl Selman, Mondays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to What Women Must Know, a show about holistic perspectives and solutions for women's health matters. I'm your host, Dr. Sheryl Selman. I'm a naturopathic doctor, author, lecturer, contributor to many health magazines around the world, and passionate advocate for women's health and well-being. And this is a show that allows us to have in-depth exploration and conversation to subjects that women really must know. I want to be sure everyone is aware that I have a very educational, informative, and free website. If you have not yet visited whatwomenmustknow.com, I really encourage you to do so. Just sign up there, opt in. I've got special reports on hormone myths and truths, special reports about how to really look after our adrenals, what we need to understand about adrenals. I've got many, many, many free articles, and I have some really exciting programs and new information that I've been researching that will be forwarded to everyone on my list, so don't miss out. Just sign up to whatwomenmustknow.com. It's there to empower and enlighten you with truthful information so you can make the best decision for your health needs. And speaking of health needs, you know, we've had many shows talking about the looming problem, the looming epidemic of obesity in this country. And I probably will announce it here for the first time that I will be doing another one of my six-week Ultimate Fat Loss and Rejuvenation tele-seminar programs with homeopathic HCG starting the end of the month. And again, if you go to What Women Must Know and opt in, that's the way you're going to find out about it. But let me just share a little bit about my own personal journey. For many, many decades, actually, my weight would go up, would go down. Sometimes it would go up a lot. It never went down a lot. It would just come down a little bit and then, you know, on upwards again. So personally, I have struggled in the past with weight issues, and I was a vegetarian for 20 years. Unfortunately, I was a very poor vegetarian because really eating Häagen-Dazs ice cream for lunch does not really define a good vegetarian diet. So I kind of, you know, did my own thing, and it turned out to be an absolute disaster for my health. When I started to put on weight, especially around the middle, as happens to so many of us once we get into and beyond menopause, I felt I was really stalled, I was really stuck. And nothing could get rid of that extra weight that was piling up around the middle especially. And that's when I was introduced to this homeopathic HCG program. And what I learned on this program, which was extremely successful for me four dress sizes later, but what it really opened up was the window into a low-carb world. Now, for many years, I became gluten-free. I realized I was gluten intolerant, and it was contributing to a lot of my problems of inflammation, of arthritis, of allergies, of autoimmune diseases, all of which I had. And the awareness that eating a diet with a lot of gluten-containing foods was really a piece of this puzzle. So I eliminated the gluten foods, and I improved. It was still an issue with weight. And after going through the program on homeopathic HCG, which really freed me of my cravings, I have now been eating a very low, if not no, carb diet. And I have to say, I have finally found the real key to maintaining my healthy weight. So today, we're going to be exploring the truths about a low-carb diet, what that's about, what it means, all the ins and outs of how to make the best decision for you to not only in losing weight or I'd like to say, gaining your optimal weight, but also maintaining your optimal weight, because it is critical for not only our aesthetic purposes, but as is coming to light, it is critical for our health and well-being long term. So, to help us navigate through this world is my guest today. I'm really thrilled to have him on the show with me. It's Johnny Bowden, Dr. Johnny Bowden, who is a board-certified nutritionist with a PhD in nutrition and a master's degree in psychology. He is a nationally renowned expert on weight loss and nutrition and the author of 7 best-selling books. And the book we're going to be looking at is his revised edition of Living Low Carb, How to Choose the Diet That's Right for You. And Johnny, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
And I loved your introduction, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know,
well, I mean, about well, no, the part about, because I think people need to hear this also. It's the part about you having tried the vegetarian diet for so long and then found that it actually wasn't really working for your health. And I would just like to kind of temper that a little by saying, anything that we're going to talk about today, and I'm sure you would agree with this, as far as low-carb diets go, are not necessarily the prescription for every person on the planet. But there are many people who had the same experience as you did, trying vegan diets or vegetarian diets for a number of years, and maybe at a certain point in their life it was very good for them. It was balancing. Maybe they had been eating a horrible American diet, in which case any change is going to be a good one. But many people find, as you did, that for the long run, for ultimate health in the long haul, that is not necessarily the way to go. It may work for some people, but it works for a lot less people than you might imagine.
And, you know, that's such an important point. There is no one size that fits all. We have to really understand that our real goal is to tune into our own bodies and observe what's going on, notice how we feel, notice what we are, intuitively drawn to, learn from experience and find what mm-hmm. is best for us. And that's why you can't belong to any camp. And the other really profound thing you said, in my opinion, is that things change. And what may mm-hmm. be good for you at one point in your life may not be the appropriate diet, in this case, as we're talking about diet, for you in another phase of your life. And you have to have the flexibility and the openness to reevaluate things, as I had to do. Because let me tell you, when I was a vegetarian, I was a staunch vegetarian, as tends to happen. And, we tend to get judgmental. And I fell into that category, and it took a lot to get me to reevaluate my allegiance to a belief system that was no longer working for my body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very, very well put.
You know, and I'll just kind of throw this in, and I'll just throw it in because it, you know, and then we can move on. But I was introduced to genomic testing, personalized genomic testing, which actually mm-hmm. through saliva testing, you can look at critical modifiable genes that impact some profound aspects of your health. You probably know about genomic testing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I had that done, and for me, it's the most accurate way to assess everyone's individual tendencies or predispositions. And what came out very clearly in that genomic testing was that my body is compromised in how it deals with glucose, and a low-carb diet was actually recommended for me to maintain my health and my weight. So it's kind of gotten that validation through that testing, but I already arrived at that place anyway.
Interesting, and I do want to mention one more thing, and God knows I'm not usually on the side of the vegetarians, but I do want to point something out. You can even do an Atkins diet and be a vegetarian. This is something a lot of people don't know, and in fact, there was a major study published, and it was either in the Archives of Internal Medicine or Circulation, I don't remember which, but it came out last year, and they designed a vegan-type diet that was low carb and actually very Atkins friendly. They called it the Eco Atkins diet. There was not an animal source of food on the program. And they limited carbohydrates to about 120, which many of us wouldn't consider really low, but it's certainly like lower than what most Americans eat. And they found that they got the same changes in weight, They also looked at things which I don't happen to believe were important, such as blood cholesterol, but that went down as well. And so it's perfectly possible to design a Mediterranean-type diet that's low-carb, to design a vegan diet that's not easy to do, but it can be done. So let's not let's make sure that people are not equating a low-carb diet with a diet that is all meat. It does not have to be all meat. There's a lot of ways to do it. What the purpose of a low-carb diet, there's one purpose only. That is to control the hormone insulin, which is your fat storage hormone. That's the purpose of it. It can be done a lot of different ways.
And so let's start there in this conversation. Let's talk about carbs, what they do, why they are a risk for so many of the health problems, including, as you were saying, with the insulin levels, with diabetes, with obesity, but inflammation, the whole set of parameters that are now we're really looking at seriously as major factors to all these conditions. So we'll just start at the beginning and then build the story.
Okay, well, the story really begins with a hormone called insulin, and here's how it works. It's really very simple biochemistry, and I know when you say simple biochemistry, people's eyes glaze over, but this is really a kind of funny, interesting, and user-friendly kind of story. Here's what happens. When you eat food, any kind of food, except for pure fat, your blood sugar goes up. You eat carbs, it goes up a lot. You eat protein, it goes up a little bit. You eat fat, it doesn't go up at all, but most people eat mixed meals. So after eating, your blood sugar rises. Because elevated blood sugar is very dangerous, the body has a number of mechanisms to keep it in a healthy range. The big gun in that arsenal is a hormone called insulin. So when you eat food and your blood sugar goes up, the pancreas notices that, and it secretes, it gives a little squirt of this hormone called insulin. And insulin has many jobs in the body, but the one we're going to focus on right now is get that sugar out of the bloodstream and get it into the cells where it can be used for energy. Now, when that system works well, there's no problems. Problem is, it doesn't work so well, and it doesn't work at all for about 25% of the population, and it works less well for, we don't really know what percentage, but I would imagine another 50% of the population, it doesn't work quite as well as it should, and there may be 25% of the population for whom it works just fine. So here's what happens when it doesn't work so well. You eat a high sugar meal. And I'll come back to the definition of that in a minute. It does not just mean you put a lot of Dominoes on your cornflakes. It means anything in the meal that converts quickly to sugar. And that includes cereal, pasta, rice, there's just, you know, potatoes, all of those vegetables and grains, they convert to sugar very quickly in the body. So the body sees this as a big sugar hit. Blood sugar goes up, and the pancreas goes, oh, my God, we better get busy and get a lot of insulin in there because this is going to be a big job, getting all the sugar out. Now, as we get older and we start being active and we have sedentary lives, the insulin takes that sugar into the muscle cells, and the muscle cells say, what do we need it for? This guy's going to be sitting around all day using a computer, and then when he gets home, he's going to be sitting on the couch using the clicker. We don't need any energy. Take it somewhere else. So insulin's got to get that sugar out of the bloodstream. So where does it go? It goes to the fat cells, which give it a nice big welcome, and they'll pack it in. Now, after a while, if you're constantly stressing this system, eating high-carb meals that send blood sugar skyrocketing, sending your insulin tanks, you know, just shooting out all their big guns, and the cells aren't having any of it, you become what's called insulin resistant. In other words, the insulin and the sugar are knocking on the doors of the cells, and the cells are saying, not interested, we gave it the office, go somewhere else. Now you have a situation where you have both high blood sugar and high insulin, and you're on your way to diabetes. And if you manage to somehow dodge that bullet, you still have a great likelihood of having what's called metabolic syndrome, which increases your risk for heart disease and also increases your risk for diabetes.
And that is kind of sums up the real peril that we are facing because we are a very high carbohydrate consuming country, which we never used to be, right?
Right. And may I also add that not only is it diabetes and heart disease, which, believe it or not, a lot of people say, well, I don't have to worry about that, there's medicine for it, but it is virtually impossible to burn fat in the presence of high levels of insulin. Insulin locks the doors to the fat cell, so they do not give up their goodies for burning for energy. They insulin is kind of like this hormone that gets stuff into the cells, but then it will, if it's present in large amounts in the body, the fat cells will not give up their contents, and you can't empty them out and use what's in there to burn for energy. So it is just fiendishly difficult to lose weight when you're insulin resistant or when you have high levels of insulin, which is usually going to lead to insulin resistance. And this is the connection between weight and this hormone. And the treatment is a very simple one. Control your insulin levels. That is completely modifiable by the foods that you eat. And once you bring insulin levels back down to where they should be, then the whole fat burning process can continue.
So when we talk about carbs, let's just define what a carb is, because I think people are really confused. They don't quite know what a carb is when we talk about carbohydrates. And I think it may seem like kind of an obvious thing for us, but I think it's always good to really define our terms so people really understand everything that is categorized as a carbohydrate.
Oh, it's actually pretty easy. It's a very broad. There are three macronutrients. Macronutrients are the large food groups, if you will: protein, fat, and carbohydrates. Those are the macronutrients. Micronutrients are vitamins and the little things that are found in that. But macronutrients, you've got protein, fat, and carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are a very big category. It includes everything from a Twinkie to cauliflower. It includes everything from Brussels sprouts to an ice cream bar. So it's a very wide range of foods that are in there. And when we talk about lower carb diets, most people think in terms of just cutting out everything that's a carbohydrate. And that's usually not what we're talking about, because vegetables are carbohydrates. And most low-carb diets consider vegetables almost a free food. I mean, there are exceptions, but you can eat a ton of vegetables on the middle stage of the Atkins program, for example. Fruits are carbohydrates. They're a little bit more problematical for some people, but they're still something that you can incorporate. Maybe not as much as vegetables, but they certainly do, have a lot of nutrients and a lot of stuff that's good for you. The ones that we talk about limiting, when we talk about really trying to control insulin, are your pastas and your breads and your rices and your starches and your potatoes and all of these foods that translate to, that turn into sugar very, very quickly in the body, because those are the ones that pump insulin out, and that's exactly what you don't want to do if you want to lose weight.
Right, right. So it's really understanding the real risk that is occurring when we consume a high percentage of carbs on an ongoing basis. And as we get older, we are less able to manage that. Can you kind of maybe elaborate why it's harder as we get older?
Well, again, it's just like your hearing gets a little bit less sharp when you get older. Well, the cells naturally get a little bit more resistant to the action of insulin as we get older. And so we have to make even more of an effort to make sure that that hormone is not being shoved up into the stratosphere with every meal. It has long-term ramifications and consequences, one of which, just off the, right out of no particular order of importance, is it raises blood pressure. Why? Because insulin sends a signal to the kidneys to hold on to sodium. Hold on to sodium, your blood pressure goes up. So one of the reasons that blood pressure tends to go down on low-carb diets is you don't have so much insulin hanging around all the time. So it really is, and for those who are interested in aging, there's a wonderful study back in 1997, which I quote in the book Living Low Carb, which they looked at the characteristics of centenarians from a blood analysis level, you know, not like the Blue Zones where they went and looked at their lifestyle and their diet and their community, but just like they measured the blood of these people who lived to 100 and were living, you know, pretty healthy, self-sufficient lives in you know, at the age of 100. And they found three characteristics of their blood: low fasting blood sugar, low insulin, and high HDL cholesterol. So, you know, a high level of insulin is a real danger sign if you're trying to live long and healthy and optimally and at a lean body weight.
So people need to really appreciate that it's not just the amount of sugar we're consuming, which of course is about 150, 175 pounds a year per person, but we really need to know that the carbs, especially the greatest the culprits that increase the sugar, that become sugar in the body, like a lot of the breads and pastas and I guess even potatoes.
Starches. Absolutely potatoes.
Right. I mean, so they are all adding to the sugar load. And I often say to people, when you're eating all those cookies and cakes and, you know, you go into your local Starbucks and you see that case filled with all those cupcakes and crumb buns and everything else, it's like pouring sugar down your throat. You don't think of it that way, but it
That's
is.
Exactly right. That's exactly right.
No, you go ahead.
I once had a conversation with John McDougall about this, who is a very sweet man and very well motivated and needs to go back to biochemistry class. And when I was explaining that all of these starches that he recommends to his patients, you know, the breads and the pastas and the potatoes, by the time they hit the esophageal sphincter and go into the stomach, they are seen as a bolus of sugar. That's simple biochemistry 101. There is no arguing with that. And he insists that these are the healthiest foods in the human diet, and they're just not. And the body sees that as sugar. We have a measure for how quickly our blood sugar goes up in response to a food. It's called the glycemic index. It's an imperfect measure. A better measure is something called the glycemic load. But basically what both of these things are trying to get at is how quickly does your blood sugar go up, and therefore your insulin, when you eat a food. There are foods like beans that you eat them on a Tuesday, your blood sugar goes up by Wednesday. I mean, they're the slowest burning carbohydrates on the planet. And then there are foods like white bread or potatoes that you know, by the time you finish chewing, your blood sugar is on the roof. So, this is another way to measure. We used to use this completely outdated terminology of complex carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates, and we used to think simple were bad and complex were good. That's utter and complete nonsense. White bread is a complex carbohydrate, and apple is a simple carbohydrate. There's no dichotomy in terms of good and bad for those two categories. But there is a dichotomy between fast burning and slow burning. You know, the beans, the things that are really low on the glycemic scales, versus things that are very high on the glycemic scales. And that does tell us something useful about the impact of food on our blood sugar. And again, let me just reiterate, why we care is that high blood sugar produces high insulin, produces the impossibility of losing fat.
And maybe we should just continue on from that point. And the more we are putting on fat, the more we're creating a condition that is generating inflammation, because this kind of toxic fat produces inflammatory chemicals, and also produces chemicals that are produces a type of estrogen. So we are raising our estrogen levels, so the hormones get out of balance, and estrogen is a fat-storing hormone in its own right. Mm-hmm. So there we go.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a little tangential, but it is important to understand. We used to think 20 years ago, we used to think that fat was just this kind of annoying, you know, stuff that sat on your hips and it didn't really do anything except, you know, make your jeans not fit well and make you feel terrible on the beach. But in fact, fat is an endocrine organ. There's about 35 different chemicals that are secreted from the fat cells, and about 34 of them are bad. Many of them are there to self-perpetuate the fat cell itself. There are appetite-stimulating hormones. There are hormones, like you mentioned, actual endocrine hormones that come from the fat cells, and all kinds of compounds, inflammatory cytokines, all of these things that actually increase illness ill health on many different levels. So fat doesn't just sit on your hips. It does a lot of bad things. And the more you have of it, you know, the more you have, as you point out, things like inflammation, which are probably far more dangerous to us than cholesterol ever was.
Right. And, you know, the other thing I want you to talk about is the fact that carbs actually can have an addictive quality to us.
Well, it's not just the carbs, but as David Kessler pointed out in his quite excellent book last year, The End of Overeating, these foods are very carefully engineered, just as the tobacco companies engineered cigarettes to have a number of different components that increase the likelihood that you would become addicted to them. The food companies do exactly the same thing with particular layers of fat, salt, and sugar. And they do it in such a way, it's diabolical, actually, when you think about it, when you read the description in The End of Overeating. But they literally do create these taste combinations that override any kind of natural appetite control we might have, and they do, in fact, become addicted. And there's experimental evidence on this. There's research from Princeton that shows that if you take rats, you know, you can addict a rat to cocaine. And when you withdraw the cocaine, they have all of the symptoms of withdrawal. You know, they shake and they'll do everything they can possibly do. They'll peck at a little, you know, lever until they die just to get the stimulation of the cocaine. So that's addictive behavior. You do the same thing with a rat and sugar, and you get a very remarkably similar kind of behavior pattern. When it's withdrawn, they act like a drug addict in withdrawal. They shake. There's very little doubt at this point that sugar can be an addictive substance, not only to rats, but certainly to anybody who looks at a portion of Haagen-Dazs as ending when the spoon hits the bottom of the carton, as I often have. So, you know, these foods, people understand from their own experience, are very addictive. It's no accident that the slogan for one of the potato chip companies was, "I bet you can't eat just one." You're darn right you can't eat just one.
Yes, it's designed that way.
It's basically
designed
that
what
way.
You're saying.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, you know, that's a challenge that we have to face, is that even though our intentions may be noble, we may actually be more addicted than we ever thought, or it may be an addiction that drives us. And essentially, I tell people if they can hold off for 7 days, they basically can withdraw off of that. What's your experience?
I think it varies from person to person, but and sometimes it's a little longer than that. But it does appear that the worst of it is over, and your taste and cravings do change and do modify. I don't know that there's a perfect number of days or months that takes to happen. But much like with cigarettes, you know, I was a smoker. Cravings stop. They come and go, you know, they rear their ugly head for a while there, and then they go back down, but eventually it isn't part of your life anymore, and you don't crave it as much.
Right. So so this is, I mean, I love this conversation. It's really getting to the heart of what is driving our health problems, our overweight problems, and, you know, we're really touching on some key things here, Johnny, and I so appreciate your ability to communicate in a really clear way.
Thank you.
That's just so important.
Thank you.
Well, you know, in your book, Living Low Carb, you talk about some of the myths. Are there any other myths that you feel we need to touch upon that we haven't talked about yet?
Oh, my God. There's so many myths about low-carb diets that they cause kidney problems, that they leach calcium from the body and it cause bone loss. The utter and complete myths. And I go over them, and in Living Low Carb, I actually footnoted that book probably more carefully than any other book that I've written for the general public, because so much of the information is controversial and stuff that it goes against what mainstream medicine says and what your doctor may have told you about fat and cholesterol. So I literally footnoted God, every other sentence with a study backing up whatever point I had been making, because some of these points are so difficult for people who have been raised to believe that saturated fat is the root of all evil, that, you know, heart disease is about cholesterol, they don't pay any much attention to sugar, they're wildly concerned about fat, and, you know, to really change those impressions, it's going to take quite a while. I don't know that in my lifetime they will ever figure, they will ever eventually get to the point where they realize it, the whole cholesterol madness was one huge mistake. But I don't know that that'll happen in my lifetime. I have no doubt that it will happen, but it takes a very long time to change that.
And I mean, carbohydrates can contribute to putting our lipid profile out of balance, right?
Well, absolutely, because number one, here's one little interesting factoid, and I urge any, if there's a medical doctor out there who disagrees with me, show me the study that contradicts what I'm about to say. On a low-carb diet, not 90% of the time, not 95% of the time, but 100% of the time, triglycerides will drop. 100% of the time in every study that's ever been done on low-carb diets, triglycerides drop like a brick. Why? Because the liver makes them out of sugar. It takes the sugar, it bonds it to three little fatty acids, it makes a nice little triglyceride, and it just loads them up in your bloodstream. And when you stop eating those carbohydrates, no more triglycerides, get down to normal. Now, is this important? I happen to think it's more important than cholesterol. Triglycerides are an independent risk factor for heart disease and stroke. They're not a good thing to have high levels of. And you can drop them like a rock if you go on a lower carb diet. So that's a very, very important thing to know about lipid profiles.
You know, we have to take a break, but before we go, I want you to kind of highlight in bold, red flashing letters what you just said. Because
okay,
that is so critical, that when you eat carbs, it forces, well, go ahead, you say it.
Well, the liver takes that excess sugar, binds it up with some fatty acids, and makes what's called a triglyceride. Triglyceride is three fatty acids bound to a glycerol sugar molecule. More sugar, the more triglycerides. That's just what the liver does with it. It takes that excess sugar and packages it into these little fatty things called triglycerides, which are 95% of the fat in your body and in your bloodstream is triglycerides. So if you want that to come down, you lower the amount of carbohydrates in the diet, and it happens every single time, every single study, across the board, 100% of the time.
So
eating this is a very important... I'm sorry?
Well, I was going to say, that's such a critical statement. Eating a high-carb diet has created high triglycerides.
It does. And eating a low-carbohydrate diet drops them. Now, why...
Wait. Let's hold that thought, Johnny, because I have to take a break. So
okay,
I don't want anyone to go away. We're listening to Dr. Johnny Bowden. We're talking about living low-carb. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman on What Women Must Know. Hang in there. We will be right back for this fascinating and critically important conversation.
Driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to What Women Must Know. We're having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Johnny Bowden, author of Living Low Carb. And Johnny, let's continue with what we were talking about, that direct connection with these really serious lipid numbers that people come back with high triglycerides and then, of course, all the recommendations to be put on medications. But really what you have told us was that it's directly related, that the high triglyceride readings is a symptom. It's a casualty to our body
damage of a high carb diet. Now, here's another interesting thing that may blow the minds of many people who are listening. I hope it does. I hope it at least gets you thinking. We used to, you know, one of the things that's entrenched in modern medicine is the concept of cholesterol being a causative factor in heart disease. That concept happens to be wrong, but let's leave it. Let's let that sleeping dog lie for the moment. We used to think, at one point, when I was a kid, we thought just cholesterol. People just got their cholesterol measured. They didn't even know about good and bad cholesterol. Then, you know, a couple decades later, we heard about HDL and LDL, good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. You wanted the good cholesterol to be high, but you wanted the bad cholesterol, LDL, to be as low as possible. Well, even that information is now out of date. There are now at least, we know of at least four or five kinds of HDL and about five to seven kinds of LDL. They are not all the same molecule. Let's talk about the LDL for a second, the so-called bad cholesterol. There are two important subtypes of LDL cholesterol, and this is really, really important, so please follow me on this. There's LDL-A, which is like big, fluffy, think of cotton candy. You know, the molecules are big and fluffy. They don't really damage anything. They're kind of harmless. Then there's LDL-B, which are like little tiny BB pellets, and those guys are not so benign. Those are the guys that break down the walls and injure the vascular system and cause plaque. But both of these things are under the category of LDL. Now, when you eat saturated fat, very often, not always, but more often than not, your LDL, that large category of quote-unquote bad cholesterol, will go up, and your doctor will go, oh, my God, we got to put him on a statin. He's eating this low-carbohydrate diet. I told you the Atkins diet was dangerous, and his LDL has gone up. But here's what happens. When you do a subparticle test on the LDL, you see what kind of LDL it is. What tends to happen is that the big fluffy molecules are going up, and the BB pellets are going down. The overall number may be higher, but your blood lipid profile has just improved significantly. I'd rather have a high LDL that's mainly those big fluffy molecules than a low LDL that's all the BB gun particles. And this is something, it's only starting to be done where they're doing the particle tests now to see what kind of LDL you have. But what they're finding when they do this is that even when cholesterol goes up, in response to eating a little bit more fat in the diet, it tends to be the harmless kind of LDL that goes up, and the dangerous kind goes down. So you're actually even improving your cholesterol profile, even though the overall number may go up a little bit.
And those are important distinctions for people to have.
You mean the LDL?
Yeah.
No, it's a very important distinction, and it's not widely known. It's certainly being more widely known in medicine and in nutrition, but it hasn't sort of broken through to the public. They don't routinely do the particle test on LDL. They still, you know, just do HDL and LDL, good and bad. But that's a really outdated way of looking at cholesterol.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about switching to a fat-burning metabolism, because I think this is getting to the crux of what we're looking to do when it comes to the weight loss challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did a webinar not too long ago on my diet boot camp program, and a lot of it was an attempt to answer the question, what plan is best for me? And, you know, as you know, there are hundreds of them. Every January, every June, the bookstores are filled with those new U tables of every latest diet book you can imagine. And basically, 95% of them say the same thing. Exercise more, eat less calories, eat less saturated fat. That's kind of the prescription, and they just package it in different ways. I would argue that the best plan for you, beside the one that you will actually follow, which is the definition of a good plan, one that you actually do, is the one that controls insulin. Because at the heart of the fat-burning metabolism, at the heart of the fat-storage metabolism, the heart of every issue that has to do with fat, is this hormone that drives fat storage called insulin. And it's not that insulin's a bad hormone, it's that it needs to be in balance, it needs to be in a zone, what Barry Shears called the zone. He was really talking about the zone of insulin. And when it's in that zone, it does all the good stuff it's supposed to do, you know, getting sugar into the cells, getting amino acids into the muscles, all of those good things, but it doesn't do all the bad things that it does when it's elevated all the time, like making it impossible to lose fat, like raising blood pressure, like contributing to aging and inflammation, all the other things we talked about. So controlling insulin, getting it down to a healthy, normal level, is probably the most important thing you can do in any dietary program. And the only dietary programs that really do that are those that try to control high levels of processed carbohydrates.
To summarize what I hear you saying is that what has gotten us down the track to an epidemic of chronic illnesses in our 21st century is a diet that has switched to high-carb foods. Basically, mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk about chemicals being added to it and, you know, all the other things that can alter our body's ability mm-hmm. to deal with sugars as well. But mm-hmm. really, we're in this predicament because we have had our diet altered, adulterated, and then we're surrounded by high carb foods all the time, and then we have that addictive tendency which has been mm-hmm. programmed into the food, so we are craving mm-hmm. carbs, and that basically is kind of the bottom line of what we're mm-hmm. facing right now, and why what you're saying is so important to get us back on the right track and the way our body was designed to function optimally in the past, in our ancestors.
Exactly, and the statement I always like to go with in my lectures and my workshops and in my DVDs and anywhere anyone will listen is to point out the human genus, predecessors of Homo sapiens. The human genus has been on the planet for about 240 million years. Homo sapiens about 100,000 years ago. Agriculture wasn't invented until 10, 11,000 years ago, so we didn't even have grains and crops. So for, you know, if you look at it as a 24-hour time clock, modern agriculture happened at 11:54 p.m. Mm-hmm. So what did we do for the rest of those couple hundred thousand years that the genus has been on the planet? Wouldn't it be wiser to look for the foods that sustained the human apparatus, the factory-specified fuel, if you will, the fuel that we were kind of meant to run on, to get our information about that from most of the time that we spent on the planet, not from, you know, since 1957 when McDonald's came out. And for most of that time, we ate foods from what I call the Johnny Bowden four food groups, foods you could hunt, fish, gather, or pluck. You know, if you were on the savannah in Africa with a stick, what could you catch? What could you eat? Because that's basically, we call it the Paleolithic diet, and it, you know, as a kind of catch-all. What would your caveman ancestors have eaten? And that really is the model that we should use for the kind of fuel that the human body runs best on. So we didn't even have all these carbohydrates until we invented agriculture, and we certainly didn't have processed foods before about 100, 200 years ago when they started, you know, preserving things and packaging them and trucking them and putting them on supermarket shelves. That's a fairly recent addition. And our genes have not kept up with it. Our genes are simply, they are very, very slow to evolve. The anthropologists tell us our genes are about 99.99% the same as they were, you know, in the caveman days. So our genes evolve very slowly, and I don't believe they have evolved yet to run smoothly on a diet that is as carbohydrate intensive as the one that we all are familiar with from the American diet.
Right. So, can we talk a little bit about ketosis? Because you talk about that in your book, and that's a really important concept and something that people really don't understand. So let's clarify that and talk about its importance.
Well, let's first define it. Ketosis came to prominence in the dietary dialogue, so to speak, when in the first Atkins book, he talked about going into this fat-burning metabolism in which you would be burning these incomplete fat molecules called ketones, and your body would be in ketosis, and it would just be, you know, dietary heaven because you'd just be burning fat all the time. It's the concept a little bit, it's less critical to low-carb diets these days because you don't have to be in ketosis in order to get the results of a low-carb diet. There are definitely some people who are just so resistant that that is the only way that they can actually burn fat is to be in ketosis. And you get into ketosis when your carbohydrate intake is just phenomenally low, like 20 grams a day, you know, which is basically a couple of cups of lettuce and salad. You know, it's very, very little carbohydrate. But the fact is, you really don't have to be in ketosis in order to get all of the benefits of a lower carbohydrate diet. And you know, you probably would not be in ketosis with 80 grams of carbs a day or 60 grams or 100 grams, yet all of those would be a significant improvement over the current, 300 to 400 grams of carbohydrates a day, which drives blood sugar up, insulin up, and makes you fat. So, you know, bottom line on ketosis, it's not dangerous. Ketones are a perfectly acceptable fuel for the heart and the brain and the muscles. They function perfectly well on it, but most people don't have to go that extreme to get into ketosis in order to lose fat.
Okay, so then from your experience and what you're writing about and committed to educating people about, what would be an ideal way to eat for health?
The four food groups. The food that you could hunt, fish, gather, or pluck. So we're talking And I want to come back to this question of animal foods, because there is a multi-layered issue here that involves ethics and sustainability and humane treatment for animals. All of that comes into the picture. But right now, I just want to talk about it from the point of view of biology and what the human being does best with, not from the other stuff. Not that that's not important, but I want to get to that in a second. So from the point of view of health, in my belief, humans do better with some animal foods in their diet. You can't get a real significant amount of omega-3s from plant foods. You can get it from flaxseed, but it's not the same omega-3 that's found in fish. There's really no B12 in the plant kingdom, and I know the vegans and vegetarians love to give you a thousand examples of that. It's just not true. Mm-hmm. You can't really get B12 from plant-based foods. Heme iron, which is the most important kind of iron, is really only found in meat. So I would say some animal foods, lots and lots of plant-based foods. You can be on a low-carbohydrate diet and eat a ton of plant foods, as I've pointed out many times. There's nobody saying not to eat vegetables. But I think that the healthiest diet is some combination of, a certain percentage of animal-based products, fat, fiber, and a ton of vegetables with maybe a little bit of fruit. So you got fruit and nuts and berries and grass-fed beef and wild salmon, and I think those are the mainstays of a really healthy diet. And the proportions can be adjusted, and there are a lot of different factors that come into play. But basically, I think that's a good blueprint to start with. Now, I want to get to that issue of animal welfare and sustainability and all of the other things that come with eating animal foods, because those are things I care a great deal about, particularly animal welfare. And it is very difficult to recommend supermarket meat. Even though it, has the same effect on insulin as grass-fed meat. I mean, you can't really, in terms of fat, in terms of gaining fat or losing fat, meat is meat. But from a health point of view, meat is not meat. Factory farmed meat, in addition to being the most horrendous, inhumane, horrible way to treat animals on the planet, is also just a health disaster. These cows are fed grain, which is not their natural diet. That makes them acidic. That means they have to be on antibiotics because they get sick. They're in confined feeding quarters, and diseases rampant. So, again, the antibiotics, they're fattened up with steroids and human growth hormone, and bovine growth hormone, excuse me, and all of this stuff that does not belong in their meat, and it's all stored in their fat cells because that's where all the toxins go. So, eating this crap from the supermarket or from a fast food restaurant is very, very hard to recommend for people. So in my judgment, the only way to balance the fact that we do better with some animal products and the fact that many of us do actually care about animal welfare and about the horrendous treatment that factory-farmed cows go through and chickens and pigs and all the rest of it is to get your meat from grass-fed ranches, 100% grass-fed. These are usually farmers who care deeply about the welfare of their animals. They slaughter them humanely. They raise them on pasture. They're happy cows. And their meat has more omega-3s. It has more CLA, which is a cancer-fighting fat that's only found in the meat and fat of grass-fed ruminants. And there's less inflammatory omega-6s. It's just a different animal, no pun intended. And so my solution to, how to balance the ethical concerns that many of us have about animals with the biological fact that we do better with some animal products is to really seek out animal products that have been prepared and raised in the most humane way possible, which happens to also be the healthiest way possible, and that's pasture-fed, grass-fed. Is it more expensive? You bet it is. Eat less of it. I mean, my answer is spend more money, eat less of the food. And you can eat it once or twice a week instead of seven burgers at the fast food joint, and you'll be getting the animal products that your body needs, but you'll also be getting them from a very safe and very healthy source.
Right. And, from the research that I've done and people I've talked to, there is quite a big difference between grass-fed beef on a nutritional basis.
Tremendous.
Just the profile is totally different on grass-fed.
Well, the omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acid profile is different, and that by itself is an important thing. Grass-fed beef has far more omega-3s and far less omega-6s than factory-farmed, and that's a very important balance for human health. Omega-6s are pro-inflammatory. Omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. You need them to be in the right balance. They're not. They're in a very unbalanced ratio in our normal diet, and so this is corrected to some extent in grass-fed beef. The presence of CLA, conjugated linoleic acid, which is a cancer-fighting fat, anti-obesity fat, that's found in butter and meat of grass-fed animals. So I think that's a very, very important, and it tastes better, by the way.
Right. One thing I want you to make a distinction on, you talked about the role of having some proteins and your fruits and your vegetables and your fats, but we need to make distinctions so people understand what you define as the healthy fats and which fats are considered dangerous.
You just want me to do every controversial thing in the world so that people
That's
go,
right.
oh, are you
That's right.
Okay, well, all right, bad
and,
fats.
And, in the remaining 7 minutes.
Okay. Bad fats are, listen carefully, it's a short list, trans fats and damaged fats. Trans fats are any hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated oil. If it says it in the list of ingredients, partially hydrogenated or hydrogenated soybean oil, whatever the oil is, it's got trans fats. Doesn't matter if the label says zero trans fats. There's a loophole in that stuff that allows manufacturers to say zero trans fats when there's anything less than a half a gram per serving. And what they do is they make the serving sizes so ridiculously small that they're able to keep it just under a half a gram, but any normal serving of the food would give you 3 or 4 grams of trans fats. So you forget the zero trans fats on the label. Look at the ingredients. If it says partially hydrogenated oil or hydrogenated oil, usually soybean oil or any of the others, it's got trans fats. Stay away from it. So that's number one. The other kind of bad fats are fats that have been damaged by reheating many times. Fats that have been, when you barbecue something at very high heat, it creates compounds that are carcinogenic. The fat bounces off the heat, and this creates a compound called heterocyclic amines, which are very, carcinogenic. So bad fats are damaged fats, fats that have been reused and heated, and vegetable oils that have been heated at very high temperatures and create all kinds of different compounds that are not good for us. So those are the bad fats. Notice I did not include saturated fat in the bad fats, which is the standard, knee-jerk answer to what good fats and bad fats are. We finally got hip to the fact that not all fat is bad, but we still but the healthy fats, which are, olive oil and stuff like that, but not butter and not, nonsense. There's really, emerging evidence, and I think you're going to see more and more and more of it, is that saturated fat was the innocent bystander in this whole thing. It is not the thing that causes the big problems. In fact, there was a very interesting study that came out last year where they looked at meat eaters versus non-meat eaters, and, they look at the rate of cancer and diabetes and all these other things that are associated with meat eating, but they did a very interesting thing, these researchers. They didn't just leave it at the meat eaters. They then looked at, they divided the meat eaters into people who ate regular meat that wasn't processed and people who ate processed meats. Mm. Well, those processed meats and regular meats have the exact same amount of saturated fat, the exact same amount of cholesterol. But people who were not eating the processed meats had not a single percentage point increase in their risk for cancer or diabetes or heart disease. Actually, it was two of the three. I don't remember which two they investigated. But the point is, only with processed meats did those risks go up. So if it's the saturated fat, that doesn't make much sense, does it? Because it's the same in both kinds of food. No, there has to be something else in the processed meats that's causing the problem, and it's not the saturated fat.
This is such a fascinating conversation, and I think it's so enlightening for people. We're going to have to continue it. I'll have you back,
you.
Johnny, but because we're coming to the end of the show, so I need your website. I need to let people know how to contact you, how to learn more about your information, your webinars, and blog. Great information. So,
Well, my website is johnnyboden.com, and it's no H in Johnny, JonnyBowden. You can follow me on Twitter. It's twitter.com/JohnnyBowden. And my website has some free audio courses and an e-book and a whole bunch of other stuff, and I have a blog, and my books are listed on the website. So you can probably find out most about me by simply going to johnnyboden.com.
And I want to encourage people to go and visit your website because there's fantastic educational information. And you've done such a brilliant job today at helping us to really understand and make those distinctions so we can get on the right track finally and eating a diet that really is going to support our health and well-being. So I just really want to thank you for the great work you're doing and for your ability to communicate so clearly.
Thank you, Cheryl. It was a pleasure to be with you.
And we'll do this again, Johnny. We'll have you back. Okay, well, all the best to you. Thank you so much for being with us today. And we've come to the end of another enlightening program. I want to thank everyone for joining me. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You've been listening to What Women Must Know. My wonderful guest today is Dr. Johnny Bowden, who is the author of Living Low Carb. And I look forward to having you back again next week. And until then, remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.